Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and I'm sitting with Dan Farrant. How's it going, Dan?
Doing very well. How are you doing, Rob?
Yeah, everything's under control. We've got a lot of shows coming out at the moment. The Summer of the Jazz Podcast has gotten completely out of hand.
Oh, yeah?
Well, the problem is that there's loads of interesting original music coming out, like all at the start of October. It's a logjam of new albums.
Logjam. That's a good word.
I'm trying to preview as many of them as possible. So there's a lot of album previews on the website at the moment. And as part of these previews, a lot of these, in fact, I think everyone has been up for giving away copies of their album to podcast listeners.
Oh, wow. Every single one? Just the one that we have?
No, everyone.
Okay, great.
So this week we're giving away a copy of Gabriel Lachin's album, Introducing Gabriel Lachin Cheerio. Next week, we're giving away a copy of the Brass Funkies album, Rabble Rouser. And then I won't spoil the surprises, but every week there's stuff. So I have a question for the audience.
Oh, what question have you got?
And the answers, what we'll do, if you email your answer to thejazzpodcastuk@gmail.com.
Oh, yeah, we're going for that, aren't
we? Big time. You've got to get the word the and the word UK. It's thejazzpodcastuk, all one word, at gmail.com.
Or if you're from the South, it's thejazzpodcast.uk at gmail.com.
There should be like an umlaut on the O or some way of distinguishing where you're from.
Yeah.
So the question, what was Kenny Wheeler's first job when he moved to the UK?
That's a hard one.
Is it?
Is it? I don't know it.
Oh, wow.
Trumpet player?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
He's Canadian. Oh, well, he's not. Yeah, he was famous for being a trumpet player.
But I can't give it away. I don't know it.
Kenny
Are
had
people
a,
allowed to Google it?
He too, oh, yeah, of course. I think that's the nature of a modern-day competition, is that...
Is it Googleable?
It's... Well, that's a really good question. See if you can find out now.
Okay. What was Kenny... Is he just referred to as Kenny, or do I have to put Wheeler?
I think you have to put Wheeler.
Does the world not know that he's Kenny?
He's not like Cher.
Wheeler's first job when he moved to the UK. Let's have a look. Nowhere Googleable.
Wow.
He's got an obituary. Hold on. This might... Anyway, this is bedtime. Let's just carry on talking.
So today's Camilla George, a lovely, super talented, extraordinarily friendly, open, warm-hearted saxophone player. So let's talk to Camilla. Camilla George, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. This is going to be fun. So where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Nigeria in a small town called Eket. And then I came over here when I was a child and growing up in West London.
Whereabouts in West London?
Well, we moved around a little bit. Well, first off, we settled in Harlesden. So I guess that's northwest.
I used to live in Harlesden.
Did you?
Yeah, cool.
When we were there, it was a dump.
Right.
It was like, it wasn't that great.
It wasn't that amazing when I lived there, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But
then, yeah, it's all hip now, but yeah, back in the day, it wasn't that great. And then we moved to Shepherd's Bush and settled in Ealing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's quite a few musicians, actually, in the Ealing way.
Who are you thinking of?
Well, my piano player...
Sarah Tandy.
She grew up in Ealing.
Yeah. Sorry, that was a bit over-enthusiastic.
Yeah, no, she's wicked. And Troy Miller actually lives in Greenford.
Right.
Who else? I think there are quite a few people, but yeah, they're the only two that come to... Oh, forgetting my bass player, Dan. He lives in Norfolk.
Oh, cool.
Dan Casimir. So yeah, wow. It's a West London connection.
That's cool. You've got a great London accent as well. I wish I had your voice. It's awesome.
It's probably the Harlesden twang.
Oh, man. So, do you remember, how old were you when you moved to Harlesden?
I think about 5.
What made your family move here?
Oh, well, my parents. My mum was born here in England.
Yeah.
My dad's Grenadian.
Right.
And they met whilst my mum was at university in Sheffield. And after they got married, they just had this dream of going back to Africa because my mum's dad is Nigerian.
Right.
And he lived in Africa with my grandma. He lived in Nigeria with my grandma. So they went back. My mum got a job. She's a psychologist, so she got a job in the university. And my dad is a tailor. So he got some work. But it just didn't work out, and actually he got deported. So that put end to their African dream.
What?
We had to come back.
That's pretty inconvenient.
Yeah, it was a bit, yeah.
Yeah, crumbs. So then, was it weird to be like, oh man, I'm in Harlesden now?
No, I think, like, Harlesden's like, no, I remember more of Nigeria from visiting after we came over here.
Right.
So, no, it was fine. And definitely it's very mixed. I guess it's probably one of the best places to go where you see people that look like you, which I guess is a thing.
Well,
if I'd been in the middle of the countryside, it might have been slightly different. But
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was cool. It was fine. But yeah, as I say, we used to go back usually in the long summer holiday.
Yeah.
That's when I'd go back and visit my grandparents.
Did they live in a nice part? What was
they
it
did,
like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my granddad was a doctor and he was a diplomat, so he had a really nice house.
Sweet.
And he had a few around, dotted around Nigeria and in Ghana as well. So it was good, you know, we could travel around. And
Yeah,
it was nice. They had lots of grounds and it's just a different way of life, you know, kind of everyone has servants there, not in a way that you have here. But just, they call them boys or girls, you know, that come and help you do this, that and the other. Because I remember everyone saying, oh, like the grandma, it's like a wicked cook. My grandma couldn't boil water, but she literally couldn't cook at all.
Yeah.
And it's just because people did it for her.
Yeah.
You don't need to know how to cook.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a different way of life, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I've been to Kenya a few times and it's quite similar, some of the places I've been, where families will have an entire staff, like, maintaining the house and living there. And but they're probably, like, families that they're not, like, mega rich, you know?
No, no. It's just the way it is there.
Yeah. So then how did you get into the saxophone?
Well, my dad's dad was actually a saxophone player in Grenada. I never actually met him because he, I think, died before I was born. And my mum's friend had a tennis sax in her flat.
Yeah.
And she was looking after it for someone, and she had been saying that she couldn't get a sound. And I went along, I was eight, and I was like, want to have a go on this sax.
Yeah.
And I got a sound out of it, and that was it. I want to play sax. But because I was kind of a typical child in that, I wanted to do loads of things. And then 2 weeks later, I didn't really want to do them anymore. My parents were a bit like, well, saxophone is, you know, it's quite a big instrument. It's expensive. You're only eight. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
So I had to do recorder.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I've never let my mum forget that.
Good for you. Stick it to her.
Yeah. But I was lucky when I got to secondary school, they had a music competition and you could just apply. You got music lessons and you could choose a sax, choose like the instrument. Obviously I wanted to do sax and I got the lessons and that's amazing.
That's really cool. What school were you at then?
I went to school in Ruislip, Bishop Ramsey. So it was a bit of a commute actually from where we lived. It was a really nice school actually. I was kind of thinking if I'd gone to another school, I wonder what would have happened because they were really focused on music without it being like Purcell or whatever those music schools.
Yeah. Man, yeah, that's really scary that, like, just by the grace of God, you're in this school that is offering the lessons and you can give it a go.
Yeah, that's the thing. And then as we progressed, there was a boy who we used to share lessons, like, have, you know, two in a lesson. And we were really competitive, which was another really good thing because I think it actually made me practice, which I may not have done at that age if it wasn't for the fact that I wanted to sound better than him in the lesson. And then he dropped off because he preferred football. And I went to a Saturday music school where I met Glenn Williams, who was one of the Jazz Warriors.
Right.
And that's how I kind of heard about the British jazz scene.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, you need to check out Tomorrow's Warriors and Jazz Jamaica. And I remember going to see Jazz Jamaica when I was like, I think I must have been 11, nearly 12. And I saw they're amazing. And that was it, really. Met Gary Crosby and Dennis Baptiste. And I was just like, I want to be you.
Yeah. That sounds great.
It was cool.
So now is that the point that you've decided you're just going to, like, play loads of saxophone?
Kind of, but I think I definitely suffered from confidence issues, I think, when I was younger. And I loved it, but I kind of was like, oh, I'm never going to be good enough to do this as a career. And also my dad, because his dad had been a sax player and he was, to be honest, a bit of a one, used to island hop and playing sax and had loads of different ladies on different islands.
Yeah.
My dad wasn't that impressed with the jazz musician lifestyle. He was not that keen. I think
anyone's ever been impressed with it.
No. So he was like, well, you know, why don't you do an academic, so-called academic degree before you, you know, do anything. So I did ancient and medieval history, actually, at Birmingham.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, well, I didn't spend that much time on the course. I mean, I met Soweto there.
Right.
Because he was living in Birmingham at that time.
Yeah, Soweto Kitch.
I don't know if he still lives in Birmingham.
I have to do that, just in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about.
Oh, that's true,
Just to clarify.
Although, Soweto, I think.
How many Soweto's do you know?
Yeah. So that's the kind of thing. And I was coming down a lot to London to play with the you know, do a lot of the Warriors sessions and stuff. So, I didn't spend a huge amount of time on the course.
But, right.
And it was after I finished that, I took a horrible job for about, was it 6 months? Probably wasn't even that long, in fashion PR, which is like, I don't know if you've seen the film Devil Wears Prada, but
I think I have, you know.
With the hideous box.
Yes, I remember that. I have seen it.
It was that, those vibes, and that was, wow. I was like, forget this, I'm going to be a sax player. Wow. And that was it. Yeah. Then I went to Trinity. Don't and need that, this. That was kind of it.
You did the Masters at Trinity.
I did, yeah.
How long were you there for?
Well, I did it part-time, mainly because I hadn't done a music undergrad course. So I thought I wanted to be there as long as possible, really.
Yeah, of course.
So I did over 3 years,
right?
Which I don't think you can do that now.
No, I'd heard someone else told me that my friend Jenny did probably the same time as you. She did it part-time. And I think she said you can't anymore.
No. But yeah, that was wicked. I met so many great players. I mean, the thing about doing the Warriors is you do have this network of people.
Yeah. What was it then? Great. Just explain it for anyone like me that's slightly confused. You know,
what,
the whole
Tomorrow's Warriors?
Yeah, and like how it, you know, how you, yeah. Well, I mean, what did you even do? Like,
oh, okay, yeah. So they have sessions, like workshops on the weekends where you can go down and you get taught basically how to improvise. You learn tunes, you learn technical aspects, and you have some of the teachers that they have, like Nathaniel Facey, and they have sometimes when the US stars come over, they'll do Warriors workshops.
Oh, cool.
Steve Coleman did one, and yeah, I mean, it's that kind of thing. And then as you progress,
man, I bet did you go to Steve Coleman's one?
I didn't go to this time, but I went to the one which is probably about 5 years ago. That was amazing.
I'd be terrified of Steve Coleman. He seems really like his music and ideas transcend the barriers of actual music. I don't know. I'd be scared he'd change my whole lifestyle. And
yeah, you know, it's hardcore. I mean, I went to one, he came to Trinity as well, and he did a masterclass there.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was with him for the first 10 minutes, and then it's like the negative harmony thing. Oh, it's struggling, but it's like, it's mind boggling.
Yeah.
He's really great. But yeah, that's like an example of the caliber of people that the Warriors will attract to come and teach their young pupils. And then you just get into bands. So they have Tomorrow's Warriors bands. And for example, you know, like Empirical, a part of that was the Tomorrow's Warriors band. I mean, it wasn't the whole.
Cool, yeah.
And then, they, you know, people go break off and they form their own bands, etc.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into Jazz Jamaica.
Do you audition for the Tomorrow's Warriors thing?
No, it's not. No audition, and it's free.
Wow. That's
so
sweet.
It's amazing. It's a great opportunity. And they often provide instruments, you know, for some people. They have a few instruments for people that just can't afford it, you know.
Right.
Yeah, because not everyone's got the money for mum and dad to rent an instrument or pay for lessons.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really expensive thing to do.
Yeah, so that's their kind of thing, is that they're really helping people that couldn't normally afford to have all those opportunities to shine, really.
Oh, sweet. And then, so tell me about the Jazz Jamaica thing as well.
Well, I got into Jazz Jamaica, I think it's about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my, all-time favourite bands. Dennis Baptiste does that. Harry Brown, trombone player, who's a legend. Rod Young's, obviously Gary Crosby, it's his band.
Yeah.
And we've gigged all over the place. We did a great gig in Mexico to 5,000 people. I think that was possibly my best gig ever.
Mexico, that's so cool.
It was so much fun, so much fun. We've got, you know, random. We don't, I guess it hasn't gigged as much as recently. But when we do go out, it's always, you know, good.
Yeah.
Good fun.
That sounds sick.
Yeah, it's pretty sick. And Dennis, like, for me, just to be in a band where I'm standing next to Dennis Baptiste, it's like you learn on the job. Every time I hear him.
Yeah, that sounds so good.
Yeah, he's such a great player.
How did you get into that from Tomorrow's Warriors? Did somebody, like, cherry pick you and be like, yes?
I don't know. I don't really know, actually. I think, well, it's just that, as happens normally, you know, somebody can't do a gig and then you get a dip. And I remember my first gig was in Bratislava in Slovakia. And they were like, do you want to do a gig in Slovakia? I was like, yeah. And then they weren't sure that I could, you know, that they needed me to do it. So it was on, off. And then it was confirmed.
Yeah.
I did that gig. And then they asked me to do another gig a few months later. And that's it. I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it was wicked. I love that band.
I feel bad for the people listening to this that know all about this stuff, because I, as you can tell, I don't know anything about anything. So this show has descended into you giving me a lesson about what the hell's going on. So tell me a bit about more, like Trinity. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. I think, you know, especially for somebody like me that hadn't done an undergrad in music, it was a great place to be. Like my mum had, she was quite keen at one point for me to go to Purcell school, but I didn't want to change schools.
Right.
And I think if I'd gone to a school like that, maybe I would have had more, you know, the Trinity background, because it's very disciplined, and that's the thing I really like about it. You know, you get people coming who've been to like Chet's or Purcell or whatever,
yeah,
and they've basically been doing music all their lives.
Yeah.
And it's yeah, that's the kind of thing. But yeah, it was great. I mean, I got to have lessons with Jean Toussaint, who I'd already met when I was 14, 15.
Right.
And I'd had lessons with him privately. He was my favourite teacher there. Julian Siegel also had lessons with him.
In solid in second place, Julian Siegel.
Oh, well. He's come across like that. But yeah, no, Julian's wicked. it was like, yeah, the lessons were great. I think for me, it's more just being in it amongst other players. Like, you know, there was just, I remember when I first got there's just so many sax players and they were all killing, and it was just yeah, it was a real kick. Kick up the backside. You're like, well, these guys are all over this, so just gotta practice. And I think that's what it was, to be honest. I think I really started to practice properly and improve when I left Trinity, because it's like you're learning how to teach yourself.
Yeah. And those courses are busy, even part-time. I bet you were so busy that it's hard to practice everything that they keep telling you while you're there.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. You have to practice the stuff that they're, you know, for your assignments or whatever it is, you know, you've got coming up, your recitals.
Yeah.
But then you also have loads of stuff that you need to practice for your personal practice.
Yeah.
And it was hard to get all of that done in the time, plus I was gigging as well. I mean, I was doing Jazz Jamaica.
Yeah,
I was in Jazz Jamaica before I went to Trinity. So I was doing that and other gigs.
Yeah,
so it's a hard thing to juggle.
Yeah, definitely.
And, but yeah, no, it's worth it.
When you got out of Trinity, then, I mean, already gigging is amazing because you don't have a kind of floating around in the
what ether. Do we do now?
Like, yeah. But what kind of stuff were you doing?
Immediately after, just continued doing the same.
Yeah.
But I had an idea. I knew I wanted to do my own project, but I wanted to spend a bit of time on my own development as a player as well. I knew there was quite a few areas that needed to be addressed, right, as a result of the course. You know, that's the thing, when you go somewhere like that, people are not, you know, they're great, but they're not going to be really nice about it. They'll just say, you need to do this.
Yeah.
This is awful or blah. So I did kind of worked on that, and I was teaching a bit, you know. And then I decided I wanted to do my own project and just started playing with people. And it's just random how I met the guys that formed my band. You know, I heard Sarah play at Ronnie Scott's at the jam session. Like, I was like, oh wow, yeah, she's killing, she's great. And then Dan, my bass player, I met him on a gig with Gary Crosby. Like, Dan came, I think he sat in, or maybe I sat in, I'm not sure now. I was just like, yeah, this guy's great and such a lovely guy too. And then Femi, I don't even remember how I met Femi, but I kind of already always known him because he was a warrior. He was in the Tomorrow's Warriors, and he came to Trinity after me, did Dan. And then we just started playing together, and I just thought, you know what, just write some tunes.
Did they all ever play together at all? No. Or did you cherry pick them all?
To my knowledge, that rhythm section hadn't played together as a rhythm section.
Right.
Prior to that, they might have played together in, you know, like individually, separately, but I don't think the three of them had played together.
Okay, cool.
Before we started doing a thing, because we started playing together in 2014.
Right.
So it's quite a long time ago now.
How's it changed over the last 3 years?
Well, I think the main thing is like everyone's grown. I feel I've grown as a composer. I think, you know, there's a lot more stuff that I kind of know about that probably didn't know about at the beginning. And as a player, and just being able to present a gig, because that's an important thing that you don't think about. But it's something that the Warriors really go on about, and I think it's something they're very strong on, is providing a show. I don't mean selling out or anything. I just mean presenting what you're doing in a way that is attractive. Because there used to be a tendency of jazz has just been like, this is a tune I'm doing, you know, like mumbling into the mic.
Yeah.
It not being something that people felt was special, even though the music was killing.
Yeah.
So that was the thing. Yeah, it's in that way I think I've grown. But also the band, my band members have grown, you know. Femi's doing amazing things. His project Ezra Collective are all over the place. They sold out Ronnie Scott's.
Femi Colioso, your drummer.
Femi Colioso, I mean, he's a serious player. He's really still really, really young, but just such a great player. He's playing with Georgia Smith now, and they're supporting Bruno Mars. I think he's just coming back from a US tour.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, he's great, got nominated for, you know, loads of awards and stuff, so he's great. Dan has brought out his own EP on the Jazz Refreshed label.
Yeah.
And he's doing really amazing stuff. His project's really lovely, like the writing's great and the playing's amazing. And he's definitely, I mean, I think he's doing the Elgar Rooms late night sessions and... that's going well. And obviously Sarah's a great player. She has a trio, and I'm sure she's writing stuff. I'm sure, like, when she releases that, you know, that would be a big, big success.
I played in Sarah's final recital.
Oh, did you? At the Academy?
606, Academy. So I'm waiting any minute now for another,
the call.
It's only been 6 years. Any day now, I'm just like sitting at home rocking back and forth.
They're all so good though. It's just, it's a great thing. I mean, of course, the downside is everyone's busy. So the great way the band has developed is I've had to sometimes use Depths.
Yeah. And who are you calling on then?
When Femi can't do the gig, I use two drummers of choice, three really. Winston Clifford, he's great. We're supporting DD Bridgewater in the London Jazz Festival, and he's going to be doing that gig with us because Femi's on tour at that time. And I've been using a young drummer called Sam Jones, who's great. He's playing with Zara McFarlane at the moment, doing some of her gigs. He's a brilliant young drummer. Again, like somebody that I think he's about 20, if that.
Wow.
Really great. And then Salim Rahman, he's a really old friend of mine. He did Love Supreme with us because Femi couldn't do that gig.
Right.
It's been great. And just it's been very interesting because for the next album that I'm writing at the moment, the core is quartet, but I'm going to have a few guests coming in. And I think having different people depping and doing the music has made me see the project in that way.
Yeah.
So Shirley came and did Brighton gig. We did the Verdict Jazz Club a couple of weeks ago. Shirley Tete on guitar. And it was great having her on. So she'll be doing something on the album. I'm going to have two drummers, a percussionist. It's just, yeah. So I think that's a really nice thing of using Depths.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That sounds cool having a, I was about to ask some really annoying question about two drummers and I've started it now, so I can't take it back. I was just imagining for some reason that you could have everyone playing at once, some kind of despicable mess, you know.
Well, yeah, I could go down that route. I was thinking more kind of like it's on the particular tune, it's like an Afrobeats thing, and I was thinking more like a drum off, but we'll see. It's it's not quite fully formed yet in my mind, but that's definitely the plan anyway.
So you guys, you have an album out already
then, yes,
in order for this to be the second one.
Yeah, Isang. Yeah, cool. That's our first one, yeah.
When was that released?
That was released in January 2017.
There's a gig at Pizza Express for that?
Yeah, we did it. We had the launch at Pizza Express. That was wicked. It was
now,
really nice.
If you go on the Pizza Express website, mm-hmm, it still says Camilla George Quartet, Isang debut album. And there's a picture of the album cover, but they've written the word "shows over" in whopping letters.
Well, hopefully the show isn't over.
I know, it's a fantastic little image. I'm sure that they just haven't thought that all the way through. So that album, did that change things for before you had it? I mean, just like being able to, I don't know, find gigs, or your, like, how people view you and your music, you know, does having that album really change things?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think before that, people knew me a bit because I'd been doing Jazz Jamaica and they might have known me through that, but not really. And I think it did definitely increase my profile. We had a really lovely lady doing the PR, and that's really helped, you know, because obviously if you don't have that in place, and to be honest, before releasing an album, I didn't understand anything about that. But now I know that if that's not in place, it could be like the most killing album ever. But if people don't hear about it, then it will just flop.
Yeah, just an instantly vanish.
Yeah. Exactly. And I've seen that happen. You know, we've all seen that with albums. You think, oh, why are people not talking about that? Oh, because no one knows.
Yeah.
So I think, it did. It became a bit easier to get gigs. Definitely when I was first doing my project, you know, having to call venues and then like, I haven't heard of any of you. Now, you know, if I rang up and said, oh, so-and-so, you know, we've got Femi and Sarah and Dan. They go, oh, yeah, we love those guys.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit easier, yeah, I think.
So do you have any time frame at all for your second album?
Yeah, it's pretty much, because I'm the kind of person that could be a bit on the lazy side, so I always like to give myself deadlines. Yeah. So really the album writing I have to finish that by the end of this month, by the end of September. And we're recording at the very beginning of January.
Oh, great. That's awesome. Where are you going to record it?
Well, I'm in the process of getting that sorted. I'm not 100% sure yet. I'm kind of deciding between two studios because I want to do it in London.
Yeah.
Because obviously with my bands being... So, you know, they're all superstars.
Yeah.
You know, it's not conceivable. Last time we did it at a brilliant studio outside of London. It's actually Ralph Salmon's studio,
oh, cool, drummer.
And it's a lovely studio. But we had like an overnight stay and stuff. And it was exciting because it's like, oh, a debut album. But so much has happened since then that it's just not, I don't think it's feasible, really. Yeah. To do that, so we're looking at a London studio.
That sounds very sensible. I like it.
Well, hopefully it works out. Hopefully I'll find somewhere.
There's a really nice one in Morden called Crown Lane Studios.
Oh.
I'm going to give them a big sell big on the plug. Show. For, yeah, big time for all the tens of thousands of listeners that we have. But it's really nice. There's a pianist called Phil Merriman. I don't know if you ever came across him.
No.
He's a... I don't know, he didn't... I think he went to Middlesex.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to stop guessing in case I'm wrong. that'll annoy the crap out of him. But his brother John runs this studio.
Oh, okay.
It's just a nice little place, but it's very sensibly priced. Anyway, I don't
That's
know.
That's the thing. These things can get expensive.
Very quickly as well, especially when, like, we're talking about not only, like, you've got to record it and mix it and master it, but you've got to pay for PR, and there's a lot.
And the bands as well. I've kind of always been on that thing, you know. I, from my point of view, I know people do it differently, but I kind of always feel like you should pay the musicians. Doesn't matter, you know, I consider them all to be good friends, but
yeah,
they're all great players and they're busy in their own right, and I feel they deserve to be paid properly.
I completely agree with you, which brings me on to asking you about funding.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have your first album funded from things other than your own money?
Nope. No, I didn't.
Oh, that's interesting.
That was an error. I applied for funding and unfortunately I didn't get it. And then my last ditch effort was for the tour, because we had a great tour. It was a 10-date tour.
Yeah.
I misread something and I got it in too late. So I don't know whether I would have got the funding anyway, yeah. But obviously it was ineligible. But this time round, I'm all over the funding.
Oh, wow.
Hopefully I'll get it, but you know, it's never a guarantee, really.
Well, I had to talk to Stan Saltzman about his big band a few years ago, and I'm going to quote this exactly as I remember it, and hopefully my memory is incredible, because he had he needed a 6-date tour to get funding from the Arts Council, and he had six, but then it fell through because one of the dates was in Cardiff.
Yes, because it's outside of England. Yeah,
yeah,
I read that. They're very strict with those things.
Yeah, I was like, but it's you, Stan, what's the problem, you know? But yeah,
yeah, well, that's the thing. I think the thing is, as I've learned, is like, even if the project's valid, like, you have to know how to speak funding talk to be successful.
Yeah.
And I don't think I did know quite
well,
how
I guess
to do
there's
that
only
before.
One way to learn, and that's not to be afraid, you know. I mean, it's a great example for everyone to look at, that you didn't get any funding and you still made the album and found a way to make it happen, which is incredible. And the world owes you a debt of thanks. But then, you know, to learn from it and to come back, and now you're making a second album and you have got some funding for it.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I hope we get it. But I think, yeah,
you better do, because I've said you've got it now.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, well, for the hopefully. First time ever, I will look stupid. So how many days would you record for?
Two. I'm hoping to do 2 days
yeah.
in the studio. And, yeah, I think that'll be enough. I think because we've played together so much, it's one of these things where I don't want it to be too over rehearsed or to spend too long doing it.
Yeah.
We learned that with we did Isang. There was one tune that we literally did so many takes. For the others, it was a couple of takes and just moved on. But this one, I was like, oh, not happy. And actually the take that I used was the first one.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So, yeah, I just kind of think, if you've got your project tight and the sound is tight, then unless something's going wrong with the actual sound in terms of mics or recording, then I don't know whether you need that long.
I totally agree with you. First or second take is always the ones before it gets a little stagnant.
Yeah, because if it's improvised music, so then it starts to sound a bit kind of too thought out, and I don't think you get the vibe that you, the fire that you get from that.
Les Chisnell said to me once when I was little, you know, Rob, don't ever rehearse the danger out of it. And I've like lived my whole life by that, of being like, oh my God, brilliant. That means I should do the minimum amount of rehearsal, the minimum amount of practice, you know.
It's true though. There should be an element of, oh gosh, this could go wrong. And then you pull it out.
Yeah.
With the bag, really. That's my hope anyway. We'll see if I'm talking a different story in January.
When it took 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So what kind of hobbies are you into outside of playing the saxophone?
Well, kind of a little bit boring. I mean, I obviously like going to lots of gigs when I have time. I like checking out other people on the scene. There's some great players coming up. You know, you've got Nabaya, who's doing massive things. She's sounding great. Ashley Henry, Dan's band, etc. I also like cooking. I'm not that good, but I like cooking.
How do you? Why do you say you're not that good?
Is
it based on other people's reactions?
No, I think I'm just a bit of a perfectionist. No, I hopefully haven't given anyone food poisoning yet. But, no, I know it's not to the MasterChef standard as yet.
What's your favourite food? Like what, like, you know, like in terms of a nation?
Oh, okay. Oh, that's really hard. I mean, I really like Lebanese food.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I can't cook that well.
When you say Lebanese, I think of like feta cheese and like pomegranates and lamb. Is that reasonable to say these words, or is that just hopeless?
I don't know about the feta. That's like halloumi. but I kind of, the way I describe it, which might sound weird, is I think it's a mixture of Greek and Indian. Two cuisines that I also really love. And it's very spicy. Growing up with like African food and Caribbean food, particularly on the African side, actually, I just love spice. I love chilies.
Yeah.
So although I like French food and I like cooking it, like in terms of actually food that I would eat, I prefer spicier food.
Yeah.
I think I
totally agree with you about that. That's a great description of Lebanese food. I enjoyed that a lot. Suddenly I understand. I feel like I know.
I've had a lot of time to think about this because I've been eating it for years.
Oh, that's really cool. So whereabouts do you live now?
I live in Acton.
Oh, man, we live really close to each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, Where do you live? I live in Sunbury-on-Thames.
That's near Richmond, isn't it?
Yeah, really close to Richmond and Twickenham.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. No, that is close.
Man. I tell you what, actually, no, don't read out your postcode. Just for safety reasons, you never know. But I've just written Acton into Google Maps, and it's only 29 minutes right now, including current traffic conditions, for me to get there. So.
Yeah, that is close. Boy, oh that boy. Is close.
Yeah, that's really
yeah.
Something.
I live off the high road. I love Acton because it's like, I mean, there are some posher bits, but I quite like the mixture of people. I mean, there are so many crazy people on my road. There's a guy that every time I see him, he's doing a one-handed sit-up, press-up thing. Does it on the floor, on the pavement.
Outside in public?
Outside in public,
wow,
yeah.
That sounds heavy.
Yeah, I mean, he's got skills, but yeah.
He's got skills. Fair play to him.
So many people that are just crazy. And I love that. That's what makes it. Because I did look around at Chiswick, which is obviously a bit of a nicer area.
It's a bit calmer.
Yeah, it's much calmer. I like the fact that Acton's a bit rough and ready.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit, feels like it's more suiting. There are also quite a few musicians that live in the area.
Yeah.
Obviously being more affordable.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, Sunbury-on-Thames is by no means a hip place to live. Like, I'm the youngest person in Sunbury by about 40 years. Yeah. Any other aspirations for the future?
Are you blinkered
on the album at the moment?
I think I'm looking at just, you know, playing more outside of the UK and doing more European gigs, getting further afield. That'd be wicked. But also I'm just really enjoying like this kind of special moment that's happening in London with the jazz scene and just all the stuff, exciting stuff that's happening, all these great artists coming up, and yeah, it feels like it's a really great place to be.
I totally agree with you. There's so much happening. That's the thing about this podcast that keeps, I'm trying desperately to do a show like every other week, maybe every month, but there are so many people that we want to talk to that you just can't help it, you know, but be like, oh, but this person and this person and this person.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
It's really addictive place to live. Yeah,
it is. And I mean, it's definitely with the kind of thing like Jazz Refreshed, you know, that scene is just us. It's really been a game changer, and Jazz's label, Brownswood, you know, it's got some great artists on there. It's, yeah.
Do you know what label your album's coming out on?
Yeah, it's the same label, Ubuntu Music.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Yeah, no, they're really cool. I really like them. They're a small label. But Martin's lovely, and Quentin Collins is great. I mean, he's a great player. And he's going to be producing this album he did with the other ones.
Does that mean that he could pay for the whole thing by any chance?
I think he probably won't. I'll just ask him. I think that might be a no.
Worth a shot.
Yeah.
Well, Camilla, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
No worries. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been a profound pleasure. So, this is it.
Ah.
That was the weirdest end ever.
This is it. That's the Michael Jackson. This is it,
yeah. Oh my God. Just like, oh, wait a minute, it's ended. Slowly and badly. Perfect. But yeah, no, thank you so much.
Oh, no worries, that's great.
Well, Dan, did you find the answer to my trivia question?
Well, you left about 5 seconds in between, so I haven't had a chance.
All right, well, you're welcome to enter the competition. Email your answers.
I find it out? Can I enter?
Yeah, we've got
quite a week. Like a copy.
If you seem to genuinely not know the answer, so I'd be very happy to allow you in. Answers to the jazzpodcastuk@gmail.com. And then next Friday, I will do names out of a hat. Maybe on the show, names out of a hat. And
that's a good idea. Well, it might be name out of a hat.
Yes.
let's be honest. Not many people are listening to this.
Well, look, if nobody can get the right answer, please email me anyway, and the closest guess will then become the winner. And on that rather alarming note, we'll see you on Tuesday for another album preview show. Farewell.